Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and my mission each week is to bring you the most interesting entrepreneurs, business people, authors, speakers, honestly, anyone that I can find who are really excited to freely share their business wisdom, their tips, and their actionable advice with us each week. And this week, I am welcoming to the show Bernard Schoner, and I'm not sure I'm saying his name right because we haven't had an opportunity to speak yet, so I'm really looking forward to speaking with him. But he is a success story in tech entrepreneurship. He is a co-founder of Thing Magic, T-H-I-N-G, Magic, a garage-grown RFID technology company led by a small group of MIT Media Lab graduates of the Internet of Things, and I'm going to ask him about that. And he led his company through the ups and downs of a startup, ultimately selling to Trimble Navigation, a multi-billion dollar multinational tech company where he is currently working as the VP of Business Development. And in his new book, The Tech Entrepreneur's Survival Guide, How to Bootstrap Your Startup, Lead Through Tough Times, and Cash In for Success, he brings aspiring entrepreneurs face-to-face with the harsh realities, and they are harsh, of a tech startup. He provides an all-encompassing look at entrepreneurship from inception to exiting and highlighting both the glory and the pain. So today we're going to look at entrepreneurship from the beginning to the end and everything in between. Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success. And did I say your name correctly?
Almost. It's Bernard Schoner. Yeah.
Thanks
for having me on your show.
Oh, I knew I was off, and normally I get to chat with you a bit in my virtual green room, but we didn't have that opportunity. But I'm so glad you're here, and welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Well, listen, before we get started, we have an hour to chat, and I've got your book. It's a great book. Can you tell our audience a bit about yourself before I launch into the dozens of questions I have for you?
Sure. Let me first check. Can you hear me all right? Is the audio good?
Yes, it's fine. Thank you.
Okay, good. So, yeah, I'm a native German. I grew up in Germany. Went to engineering school there and in France, and then after that came to America and to MIT to do my PhD. And that's where I met my four co-founders in Thing Magic. And in 2000, when we slowly started to graduate, and when we knew we had to leave MIT and either become academics for real or do something commercial out there, that's when we decided that we would found Thing Magic, hoping that we could enjoy a little bit of both worlds. On the one hand, continue design interesting technology and basically make a technical contribution to the world. On the other hand, hopefully also have some financial success. When we decided to found the company, we were still in the middle of the dot-com boom. So founding a company was the thing to do around MIT. By the time we actually got started, that bubble had burst, and we were dealing with the realities of the post-dot-com startup lives, which was a lot less glamorous than we had hoped. And ever since, we went in and out of many cycles of boom and bust, economic crisis and economic boom. So the book I wrote is really about how Thing Magic navigated those ups and downs of the market and the economy as a tech startup, and and then how to do that for the next tech entrepreneur can help do that and come out as a success at the end of the tunnel.
Well, it seems that that's particularly important because, given what's going on in our economy, in the global economy, I think the ups and downs are going to continue to happen, aren't they? I mean, nothing is settling out from what I can see.
No, and I don't think it can. I don't think it can settle out. I mean, the issue with the economy and the issue with taking risk, especially as an entrepreneurial venture or as a tech startup, is that you have enormous upside potentially, and unfortunately, the flip side of that it's also very likely that you don't succeed. That's really the game that you're playing, right? And if every startup were to be successful, a lot more people would be doing it. But you are making a fairly significant bet that you can. You can basically succeed, and the reality is that most tech startups don't. Now, that's sort of the very high-level context, right, where you say, out of all the careers a young graduate could choose, becoming a tech entrepreneur is one with the potentially the highest reward possible. It's also one with where failure, or at least non-success is very, very likely, right? Now, the book is a lot about trying to manage that process and trying to hedge as an entrepreneur, much like investors are trying to hedge when they invest in multiple companies. But there is always going to be that last bit of risk, if you want, or uncertainty, I like to call it. But it's very difficult to predict how successful you are going to be.
Well, one of the things that I think a lot of people, it may stop them from becoming an entrepreneur is that dread of risk. So I guess my thinking, if that fear of risk is scaring them, then they're not an entrepreneur. Isn't that correct?
I'm not sure that's correct. I can say for myself that I that uncertainty, right, about where's this going, is it going to be alive in a year, am I going to be able to get a salary, and am I going to pay a salary to my employees, that fear is both certainly scary, but it's also one of the big drivers for entrepreneurs, right? Yeah, in the presence of that anxiety, one thing I can say, I worked really, really hard. Right? Mm-hmm. You go to bed and you're thinking, maybe I should have done this other thing. I should have emailed this customer or this potential customer. And then you get up the next morning and the first thing you do that, right, to follow these even small leads to make a little bit of money. So I have found that anxiety and fear to be sometimes painful, but nevertheless excellent motivator to work hard.
Right. I'm afraid, though, that sometimes just thinking about it will stop people from even starting, and that's a shame. You have to kind of get in there and find out where you're going with it. I do have a question, though. When you decided to found Thing Magic, and if you would, let us tell our audience what Thing Magic is. What were some of the first steps that you took to turn this idea that you had into an actual company?
Yeah, I'd be happy to elaborate on those early days a little bit. In many ways, we were unusual as a tech startup. We were not the group of people that had one idea and that's what we're going to market, and now we're going to look for funding. And once we find seed funding, then we get started working on our idea, right? We went to this endeavor with a much more open mind. We all had slightly different kinds of technical backgrounds, and we wanted to sort of stay true to those the things we knew how to do and that we excelled in, and apply them on a broad basis inside the company. So when we started ThinkMagic, the initial idea was that we would design technology, manufacture prototypes, and help other companies basically realize their technical visions. So initially, we worked a lot with large Fortune 500 corporations who were intrigued by the technology that would come out of MIT or the Media Lab specifically, but didn't really have the inspiration or, and in many cases, the technical talent to take those ideas and turn them into real products. So that's where we offered our services, and we said, yeah, we can do that for you. And once we get it over the over that threshold where you can say, oh, now I see it, now I get it, now I can give it to a manufacturer to make it for me, at that point we would sort of step back and let the large company do that work for themselves. That was how we got started, and that's how we funded the company early on. So we didn't have any venture capital. We didn't have any funding for the first 5 years of operation. And as we basically went through that period, very soon we realized that there was a particular need for RFID technology, radio frequency identification technology, which was an area where we have had a lot of expertise. And it happened to be an area where the market was just about getting ready to really take off. And the application for that technology at the time, it was the early 2000s, was to put RFID tags on the goods in the supply chain for the Walmarts of the world and the Procter & Gambles of the world, and then track the goods inside the supply chain. So that's where we established ourselves as experts. And when that market looked like it was really going to take over the world, that's when we decided to change our business model to accept venture funding and then turn ourselves more in a product company for RFID readers, basically the infrastructure to read those tags. And that was essentially the story that got us venture capital in 2005. And from then until we sold the company in 2010, we were basically operating as an RFID product company.
So when you say, I'm going to go back just a second here. So for the first 5 years, you basically were self-funding. You were going out, finding the jobs, paying yourselves, paying the company, and funding that way. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, we were essentially selling design services.
Okay.
Yeah, I shy away from the term consulting because it wasn't really consulting as much as it was really creating technology for other companies.
Now, when you say venture funding, what does that mean to somebody like me who has never even considered it? And I doubt that I would be needed in my particular company, but what is venture funding? How do you go about finding it? How do you establish yourself to even go down that avenue?
So, interestingly, in the book, the middle part of my book, the book is structured in three parts, and the middle part is entitled Venture Capital, A Double-Edged Sword, which sort of gives you an indication of how I feel about venture capital, right? It's often, people think of it as that magic shower of money that comes down on a startup.
Right.
And then once you basically benefit from that, then you go out and you're wildly successful. And that certainly happens once in a while, but it unfortunately doesn't happen all that often. And there's lots of examples where venture capital actually becomes a big burden on the company. And in our case, I would say it was sort of a middle ground. But to be clear, so when we talk, we mean that we work with institutional or professional investors who investment funds who give you significant amounts of money to equity ownership in the company. Unfortunately, it's not just about giving them equity ownership. So You don't just give up 20, 30, 50% of your company. You also give them additional rights that, for example, suggest that if the company gets sold and it is sold for less than the investors invested, or even as much as the investors invested, then the investors essentially get all their money back and nobody else gets anything. It's what's known as liquidation preferences, and liquidation preferences can become an extremely difficult term for the startup when things don't quite go as predicted. Of course, venture capitalists, they like to invest in ventures that are worth 10 times as much within a short amount of time. Well, that's the gamble that they take. They can make money when you really when their investment really propels the company to be worth a lot more than at the time of the investment. Unfortunately, that's a difficult thing to do, and it depends on so many factors that are not within the control of the entrepreneur, of the management team, or of the investors, right? So, and when it doesn't happen, that's when things can easily get difficult for the investors, because they struggle to get their money back, and for the company, because as they continue to have to live, they now own less of the company, they owe a lot to the investors, and it's just very difficult to find your way out of that situation. We happily did, and we were able to find a good outcome for everybody, but lots of startups don't.
So this is something that you very definitely have to do your research on and go into it with a lot of knowledge before you even think about it.
Yeah, knowledge and open eyes. And mm-hmm. I encourage entrepreneurs to be, to try to be fully aware of, the potential downsides and, if you want, the risk associated with venture capital, right? Because it's not that the investors take take on the risk and the entrepreneur doesn't get to feel any of it. It's really shared between the two entities when you go through venture funding. And it's usually you don't hear a lot about, or you don't read a lot in the media about, companies that become very successful or even moderately reasonably successful without venture capital. And we tend to hear about the big stories, like the Facebooks and the Googles, and maybe the big failures like Webvan, that spent $1 billion in venture capital funding down back in 2000. We don't read a lot about the other ways of becoming successful tech entrepreneurs, like bootstrapping, like government funding, and yet there's a lot of other options there that entrepreneurs should evaluate before they take venture capital.
I'm glad you said that. I've been seeing an awful lot about crowdfunding. It seems to be everywhere. Can you talk a bit about that? Because I know that it's now a legal method of funding, or at least, as you say in your book, some aspects of it are. But when is crowdfunding right for tech entrepreneurs, or even, startup entrepreneurs? I'll be honest with you, I don't really understand it. I see it everywhere, but I haven't delved deeply into it enough to really understand what it is. So if you could explain that, I would be very grateful.
Sure, yeah. So crowdfunding is sort of an interesting story. And historically, it has been adopted fairly widely in the not-for-profit community. So if you're looking to raise funds for an effort that you don't want to make a profit on, then that's historically where most of the crowdfunding happened. For example, if you want to make an interesting piece of art, but and you're not planning on selling it, but you're doing it for the common good, then that's a place to use crowdfunding. In recent years, it has become more common to do commercial crowdfunding. There's fundamentally two kinds. The first one is where you essentially raise funds against the promise of a delivery sometime in the future. So, one famous example from a few years ago is a company decided to make a smartwatch, and they would basically describe what the watch was going to be, and then they tell people, you can have one in 2 years if you give me $100 now. Mm-hmm. So you're basically pre-selling a product that you will have or you promise to have sometime down the road.
That doesn't sound right to me. I don't know that I would do that, but keep going. I'm very fascinated by this.
Whether it's right or not, I mean, it's a contract. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the possibility of default is rather big. if the company doesn't pull it off and they never design and then manufacture that watch, you have lost the $100, right? So that's the risk, and that's the risk that you're taking and that the investor is taking when they engage in that contract. The second type of crowdfunding is basically equity-based crowdfunding. So there you would say, essentially, we are going to organize a round of funding where we give up some stock in the company. But rather than doing it with a set of institutional investors or a small group of angels, you're going to talk to 1,000 people or even 1 million people, and we hope that some of them are willing to basically invest a small amount of money against a small stake in the company. That type of crowdfunding is not yet legal when you do it with the general public. So you couldn't today have a website that would allow anybody to make this kind of investment. You can only do it with what's known as accredited investors, which is basically people that meet a certain financial criteria. So you have a little bit of that, but it's with companies that basically only talk to this kind of accredited investor. But we expect that to change in the coming years. I call crowdfunding the sexiest of the funding methods today. And there's a reason for that, which is that crowdfunding gives you the benefit of raising money. In the first case I described, you raise money without equity dilution. So from the company's point of view, that's a very attractive offering. And the second thing crowdfunding does for you, it's really an excellent marketing tool. Because as you promise, to go back to my earlier example, as you promise a watch against a certain amount of money, you're already talking to the customers for your company, right? You're talking to someone who is interested in a watch, and that person may or may not decide to invest the $100, right, with all the risk that comes with it. So you're not talking to a sort of an abstract investor who really only does this because they want to get a certain return on investment. You're talking to a group of people who are really interested in what you're doing on the product side, and that may actually inform you about what the market needs and how you might want to change it or which direction you want to take the company to really fully respond to that market need.
Well, that makes sense. I haven't really understood it, but I see it just darn near everywhere. And it's one of those things you think, well, I'm going to go look and see what that's all about, and then, of course, never find time during your busy day. So I really appreciate you explaining that. So what do you think is going to change with crowdfunding in the near or far future? What do you think will change legally for people?
I think the one change that we're anticipating and that the legislature is basically working on is, how can we bring equity crowdfunding to the individual small-scale investor, not just the accredited investor? And that will basically, over time, allow everybody to make these kinds of bets for an equity stake in small companies. So that's the change we're anticipating. And I think it will certainly change the landscape slightly. The other thing that will do, and I haven't forgot to mention that in my earlier explanation, today crowdfunding is very focused on consumer technologies. right? If you wouldn't, spend $100 for some enterprise software to get a little bit better, because you as a consumer, you don't have, you know, any connection to that, right? So if your company is in an OEM business or in a commercial manufacturing business, crowdfunding is today not the way to fund it. That may change as we open it up as a more of an investment tool, not just a means to get an interesting new product sometime in the future.
Right, or movies. It seems that I've seen movies that are being launched this way, which I guess makes sense. I don't know. I'll have to really look at it. It's a fascinating concept, and I wish I knew the brain that came up with that. It's absolutely fascinating. Listen, in the Tech Entrepreneur Survival Guide, you say that there are lots of things that could go wrong with a tech startup and, frankly, any startup. What would you caution as the biggest mistakes first-time entrepreneurs tend to make? This, to me, is a really important question because entrepreneurship is hard work. I think people don't understand how hard we work. I mean, we're passionate, we're excited, we get tired, we get cranky, and then we get up the next morning, we start all over again. But what are the biggest mistakes that you see people making straight out of the chute?
I think, you know, especially for technologists, yeah, engineers who love their technology, love the things they're doing, love the objects that they're producing. The biggest mistake that they can make is to underestimate the difficulty to get a product or service to the customer and essentially sell it. That's where I think most technical, you know, startups fail early on because you're getting too much in love with what you're doing, and you're not really considering, you know, how well it will do as a commercial product, and specifically getting it to your customer and having a customer pay money for it. That's, I think, where most tech startups stumble early.
Well, you know, I have the same conversation with, I'm a web developer on top of being a virtual assistant and online business manager. And one of the biggest things that I tell people when I'm talking to them about a website and a sales funnel and products that they're creating is to reverse engineer it. You know, not fall in love with what it is that you do, what you can do, but what is the customer experience going to be? How are you going to convince them that they need your services or your product? You have to walk away from it and get out of the me, me, me attitude, you know, just because you've created this great process or system or product doesn't mean that you can actually sell it. I mean, you have to actually step back and say, okay, why would people want this and how do I convince them that they want this? It's tough. It's very, very difficult for people because we get so in love with what we're doing and we can't understand why everybody doesn't want it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, and I think, you know, it's also difficult because in a way we need a little bit of that, yeah, a little bit of that you person, and certainly enthusiasm about what we're doing, because that's part of the selling process, right? You can't sell just based on numbers or based on features. You have to be in love with it. Emotional element into the mix to be a successful salesperson or business development person. At the same time, you know, when you go home and you really think about what it is you should be doing to be commercially successful, you know, that's when you want to be hyper realistic and look at that thing from every possible angle to determine if you're not fooling yourself to think that it will be a commercial success.
And if you don't know, this is a big question, if your strength is in creating the product but not necessarily selling the product, isn't it time to bring on people who can help you sell it? I mean, there comes a point where you have to understand that you can't do everything, that you do need to bring on experts.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And so, yeah, bringing in people who can sell at the right time is important, especially when you can do it yourself. Unfortunately, you know, that may already be too late. It may already be too late to make good product decisions, right? So, you know, the conventional wisdom is, you create a product, and then when you have it, you bring in a sales team to sell it, right? But as I write in the book, you know, there's people out there that say, a good salesperson can sell any product. I disagree with that.
I do, too. It shouldn't be sold if it's not going to actually benefit the person or the company that it's being sold to.
Yeah, so I don't think there's this magic bullet of the sales guy who can sell anything. There is, however, a bad sales guy, I think, can fail at selling anything. I think that's true. But I don't think it's unfortunately not true in the positive. So in other words, getting to that product, many of the mistakes are already made in that phase. And then when you hire your sales team, it's already too late, and they won't be able to make a difference in the marketplace. So, being diligent about what it is you're creating, vetting it every possible way before you invest heavily in a particular product or service is very important, and it's especially important today because there's so many people out there trying different things, and if you're not spot on with what you're creating, you will have a hard time selling it.
I think that's absolutely correct. People need to understand what it is that they're going to be receiving from you. And if they don't understand it, they're not going to buy it, I think. I mean, that's just been my experience. Let's go back to startup, because I'm fascinated by this idea of starting up, because you did. You started, you started out kind of young. But that's kind of unusual, isn't it? I mean, I've read somewhere that you said something about Mark Zuckerberg. I'm trying to remember the statistics that only a small percentage of technology entrepreneurs are very young when they start out.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that the looking at the statistics for when people start tech companies, or when they start their first tech company, I should say, it's actually quite smooth bell curve, centered somewhere around 40. So the
is that after they get some real life experience, do you think? What is the cause of that?
I think a lot of them do. Yeah, I think a lot of them leave school and then they work in tech, or they work in other fields. They may have a business degree, they may have a technology degree, and then they go out on their own once they have some experience, or they get laid off, or there's all kinds of circumstances that prompt people to finally found their own thing, right? So the conventional wisdom that all successful tech entrepreneurs start in their 20s, certainly the statistics don't support that. And certainly there's a very small percentage of founders who are dropping out of college and are not even 25 before they start their company, right? That's really a small fraction. So, I'm impressed by the Zuckerbergs and the Steve Jobs and the Bill Gates, because they are actually a very small group, and yet apparently, the biggest companies in the world were founded by those guys.
Right. It seems like they were very focused and didn't look left or right. They just looked straight ahead.
Yeah, I think they definitely had certain they have skill sets, and they have a determination that's unparalleled. So I also think that they happen to do the right thing at the right time. So we shouldn't underestimate the ingredient of luck into any one of these mega stories. And I'm sure there's a few people out there that were faced similar crossroads as these big accomplished entrepreneurs, and for one reason or another, it didn't materialize, right? Some of it is economic realities, right? If you have the wrong idea at the wrong time,
or if the economy is just collapsing around you, it's difficult to make it, you know, make it that big. At the same time, yeah, there's definitely a set of skills and sort of an attitude, I think, that that helped those guys to become what they have become.
No kidding. You know, I look at some of these guys and I think, you know what? It was just something you had to do. It's something you had to do for the rest of us. It's almost like they were just chosen to do it. I don't think there are any accidents when these things happen.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident. But I can tell you that I know a lot of determined entrepreneurs with great education and skills. And yet, yeah, they never seem to be quite getting out of or getting a break in terms of having a true success with their companies. So you do rely on circumstances also, and you do rely on the environment that you happen to operate in, the people you find to work with you, the investors you find that believe in you. Some of these events in the life cycle of a company are not, predetermined. They happen, and sometimes they don't happen. When they don't happen, it's a lot harder.
So you just have to be aware and agile.
Yeah, I think you have to be agile, and you have to be, from the personal view of the entrepreneurs, you have to accept the fact that it's uncertain. The outcome of your venture is uncertain. So, for example, in our case, we, in 2003, 2004, we found ourselves in the middle of this incredible hype for our industry and our technology. And we hadn't even picked it, right? We just happened to be right in the middle of the next big thing, right? I can't give myself credit for having chosen that technology. It's just, what we happened to pick the right one, right? Only 4 years later, those fortunes totally reversed. Now RFID was the doomed technology that killed so many companies or startups that didn't make it at all. So what looked like a great fortune 4 years earlier all of a sudden became almost our demise, right? And we managed through that crisis, right? We were humble, we managed it, and basically brought the whole company home, if you want. But still, I mean, it's sort of striking that without us doing anything, we sort of find ourselves in the middle of a great opportunity. And a few years later, we find ourselves that very opportunity is almost like killing us, right? So it's those events, you don't really create them as a company. You are, to some extent, subject to them. And at the end of the day, how you manage them and how you get over those difficulties or, in some cases, opportunities is really what counts in the long run. Right?
And that leads me to my next question, because companies are people. They're made up of people. And I think a lot of sometimes this is lost, in the news stories that, companies and corporations are comprised of people. So my question to you is, what kind of personality traits do you think you really, really have to have on a team to get through the good times and the bad times? I mean, what is important to you? What are the key players doing when you're going through these things?
Yeah, so in the book I talk about the kind of roles that you want to have on your founding team to cover you in the early days and also potentially when the company is going through not so good times. And then I talk about attitudes and skills, right? And I make the point that attitude, I think, always trumps skill. So if you have the choice between someone who wants to do company with you without relevant skills, but really has this kind of fire in his eyes and the determination to make it work with you, take him over the guy who has experience or skill. I think attitude ultimately is more important. That said, it's very difficult to find sort of that right balance of attitude. So to give you just one example, as an entrepreneur, you sort of need to be stubborn, right? You can't just say...
Take at it is the way I put it.
Yeah. When there's a setback because the customer says, oh, we don't want it after all, or someone tells you, why are you doing this this product? That makes no sense to me, right? You can't just take that and then basically change course. No, you have to believe in what you're doing and push it through those sort of unfortunate events and possibly differing opinion from others, right? At the same time, you need to be very humble and you need to react when it really becomes apparent that what you're thinking is going to be successful is not, right? So when you're designing your product and you're investing heavily and your customers say, that's not what we want this, right? You have to listen and eventually you have to make a decision and say, look, I may be wrong, but... or the customers may be wrong, but they are the customers and they are the ones that are going to spend money on it. So you need to react to that and adjust your strategy and plan to basically for the benefit of the company, right? So how much of one versus the other do you need? It's sort of difficult to say, right? So you need, I think, you know, the best way of saying is you sort of have to have a lot of self-reflection. You need to be able to step outside yourself and outside your company and look onto it and say, is this really, are we really doing the right thing? Does this really make sense? And when you come to the conclusion that it doesn't, you know, you adjust. And there's a few other pairs of, sort of personality traits that with a similar property of being, you have to have one and you have to have the opposite two in order to make it as an entrepreneur. Yeah.
So are there any particular things that, you know, when you're putting together a team, when you're putting together, it's not just accident, is it? I mean, you're just because you shared a dorm, you don't start a business more often than not. I mean, you're really looking for key elements and people who are going to be part of your team.
Yeah, it's an interesting a mix of things that come together, you know, especially in those. I think someone should write a book about those early company founding situations because they tend to be very chaotic, actually.
It seems like they just came out of a dorm room. I mean, some of them you're like, okay, we're partners, and it worked.
I don't imagine that would work
all the time.
That's sometimes what it looks like, but you know, the complications behind that statement, you know, are often not as apparent, right? So say you spent 4 years in college, you were dorm roommates, you know each other well, but you know how that group thinks about the future and how the individuals think about their own future, right? Yeah, that may be very different between them, right? So one may be more risk averse than the other. One is already married and needs to support his family. Another one really wants to go into academia. So you have all these individual situations and issues and how that, and then you have the fledgling of a company or an idea that nobody really has any idea where it's going to go, right? And you throw that in a mix and you're trying to basically form a company in that chaos, that's actually quite difficult. And oftentimes, how you come out of that process can be actually quite random, right? So if it's not that you sit down and you make this plan where you basically lay out the next 5 years, how you'll be working together, who does what, and who gets how much, and who's going to invest in the company. Yeah, all those elements are parameters, and you can only hope to sort of one by one deal with them, but they are certainly not all dealt with on day one, and yet you sort of have to form a team, and you have to come up with a certain amount of commitment of every one of the co-founders, because you need to rely on each other, right? It's a very, very complex process, And I wish you could really plan it and say, oh, I want to become an entrepreneur, and I want to work with A, B, and C, and we're going to get our money from X. It doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
No. And that leads me to my next question, because early on in Thing Magic, you and your partners established the principle that every founder and key executive received the same salary compensation. Is that pretty unusual? Because I mean, that was part of the planning. That was part of how you, chose to take care of your team. Is this a good idea? Is this something that you recommend to other startups?
I definitely recommend it. I also know that it's highly unusual. And I think one of the reasons why we could pull it off is because we were independent of investors for such a long time. So we basically made our own rules, right? Nobody was telling us how to spend their money. We were spending our own money, so we could decide how.
Right.
But the reason why I think it's a good idea is because there's a number of reasons, but the most important one is that as a tech startup, you want to communicate to the team that the reason why you're doing it is not the salary that you're taking home every month. It's the equity that you want to make very, very valuable. So at the end, when you're either selling the company or you go IPO or you merge with some other company, that's when everybody gets the big reward for doing that tedious work and trusting in that entity. And a good way of communicating that idea is by saying, look, we all need to live. We all have our basic needs, and we make sure that we cover those with our monthly payments or salaries. But that's going to be the same for everybody. So don't worry whether your boss is making more than you or he's not. and then when we make this valuable, then everybody gets a lot more, and that's why we're doing it.
See, that approach makes perfect sense to me, but I guess I'm wondering why it's not common. Is it because of the way that you structured, because you were largely self-funding? Or are you even able to do something like this if you have venture capital?
I think it's not common because in our case it was possible because we were self-funded. And also the early team, we all had the same background, so there wasn't a lot of difference in terms of what we brought to the table as founders, right? So that certainly made it a little easier. The reason why it's not commonly done is, one is that when you have investors, they tend to be stingy, and rightfully so. They want you to be very careful with spending. So if you're depending on how demanding your employees are, if you're paying everybody the same, that can get expensive.
Okay.
So it certainly depends a little bit on what the company structure is and what kind of people you have and you hire, right? So there's definitely limits to that. And then it also depends on issues like you want to hire a CEO, and the CEO is not okay with the structure, right? He wants to make more. Or he has to make more because he has, kids in college or whatever the case may be, right? People have different needs. And one of the benefits that you have when you're starting right out of school, typically the needs, the basic needs of that group of people are relatively low. Right? You don't have people with mortgages. You don't have people with big families. People are okay flying economy. So that helps early on, because you can basically make that argument that I know we're paying you under market, but we will make it up, right? All the value is in the long-term value of the company for you. It's a little bit harder to make that argument with an executive in their 40s who has so many financial obligations that he essentially needs a substantial salary each month, otherwise he couldn't work for you, right? So it's not even about necessarily preference. It's really about how constrained are people in their lifestyles and how they think about work. I find it easier to work with, you know, young people who are more open-minded or can be more open-minded relative to these issues.
Right. Well, and that leads me to my other question, and you've largely covered it, I think, but and that is what should prospective employees take into consideration before joining a startup team? And I think you covered that, you know, young, hungry, really fired up. I mean, what should they be thinking about when they say, okay, I'm going to join you know, I'm going to go to your company, you're brand new, and I believe in what you're doing. What are some of the things that they should really take into consideration before they maybe not take that other job?
Yeah, the caution I give to startup employees in particular is that don't think this is the direct path to becoming a multimillionaire. There's a perception with the big mega IPOs like Google and Facebook, or big, you know, company on sales like WhatsApp, that as an employee of a tech startup, you will be a multimillionaire in no time. That's unfortunately not the reality for most little tech companies. So my first point of caution is don't do it for the money. Do it if you like working in a small environment with a small team, with the potential of nice upside, but certainly not the guarantee of upside. So do it more for the environment and the pace of a small company than the financial reward that comes with that. So, and if you're someone who doesn't deal well with the notion that you might be working for 3 different companies in 3 years, it's probably a good idea to look at something a little bit more stable, like a larger tech company. That's really how I feel about the issue.
Well, and what do you mean by working for 3 companies in 3 years? Can you explain that?
What I mean by that is that, yes, you know, startups don't necessarily go bankrupt very easily, but they certainly, when they hit hard times, they have to reduce staff fairly quickly. So you have a fairly, potentially a quick cycle of hiring and then laying off people. And that usually says nothing about the qualifications of that person, much like it says very little when IBM lays off people, right? It's just part of the business in some ways. In a small company, that can happen very quickly. And you know, as an employee, you might find yourself looking for another job very soon, right? It's usually not, it doesn't hurt your career necessarily, because people understand that being laid off in tech startup world is part of the process, but it's still a potentially difficult event to go through from the individual point of view. So that's what I mean by if you can't deal with that easily, or if that's a tough one for you to deal with, then tech startups are maybe not the right employer.
Well, and this, you know, in technology, information, anything that's going on online, this is not the good old days where you got a job at the railroad company or the bank and you stayed there until you retired and then took home your watch. I mean, it's a completely different way of doing business these days.
I think it is. And you know, I make the point in the book that, you know, risk is a very relative issue these days. So working for IBM doesn't mean you are protected from being laid off anymore, right? Large tech companies lay off people very regularly. And so that alone, I don't think is the reason to work for a large company versus a small tech company. I don't think that is. But the pace and the frequency of that happening is definitely higher in a small company environment where, if the market doesn't do so well this year, it almost immediately requires some adjustment in terms of staffing. So I think it's not a necessarily a qualitative difference between a small and a large tech company anymore, but it's probably a difference in frequency.
Okay, and that makes sense because I do understand that kind of that activity. I see it all the time. So it's really, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is if you are going to go work for a small startup company, you need to be fairly, I don't know how to say this. You need to be able to say, my job ended today. Okay, well, I'm going to go find something else that I really like to do as well. You need to be kind of upbeat about the whole thing, which a lot of people are going to say, is she nuts? But I think that's really what you have to be. You have to understand that you're taking a risk. When you're going into it, you could potentially, that job could go away, have nothing to do with you, but you need to be able to take your skills and the information that you learned and the balance that you learned there and move it to another company fairly easily.
Yeah, and I think the ability of people of employees to do that varies between individuals, so you want to really think about that very carefully and figure out what's right for you, which may also change over the course of a career. Right? There's probably times when this kind of turmoil and change is not welcome, and there may be times when it's easier to digest. But you should definitely be prepared for lots of ups and downs if you're going anywhere near a startup, whether it's as a founder or as an employee.
Okay, well, let's switch back to entrepreneurship because, as we all know, it is physically and mentally demanding. It's tough. You either are an entrepreneur or you're not, and I think you can learn to become one. But I find, personally, that most people are just kind of born with that entrepreneur gene, so to speak. So how were you able to balance your work life and your personal life in the early stages of building Thing Magic? Because I know I am an entrepreneur, and I know how many hours it takes every day, and I know what kind of toll it can take on you physically, emotionally, financially. I mean, it's people think, oh, you're an entrepreneur. That's got to be fun. It is. It'll also kill you if you're not paying attention. So how did you balance everything?
I'm not sure if I balanced it all that well, to be honest.
No.
I
thought you had the magic bullet. I was waiting for it.
I worked hard in grad school, and this was sort of, you do it because you love it, and you want to be the best at something, right, and when you're doing your PhD, and then I worked probably even a little more as an entrepreneur in the early days. I'm not sure. I made enough room for everything else in my life at the time. I noticed that there's sort of a little, and nobody can really maintain that kind of pace for a lifetime. I think there's probably a little bit of fatigue that's in at some point, and I think it's important to recognize that and not sort of blame yourself and say, oh, why can I not work as hard as I did when we first got started. I think it's a natural thing to occur, and it's also among a founder group, I think it's important to recognize those transitions that individuals make. Because if you recognize it, you can deal with them before there's a big disaster happening, right? If someone really doesn't want to continue or anything like that. So I think it's important to recognize those transition moments when either you can't anymore or you don't want anymore or you need some change in your life. I think you can probably be very, very dedicated to one thing for a few years, but I don't think you can do it forever. I think I couldn't do it forever. So when after about 5 years, and when we got significant funding, we started to hire significant people, and with that, some of the load and responsibility was offloaded to others. Right? So that helped me quite a bit, and I think it helped me sort of restructure my life on a more scalable basis, where I could say, I can keep going for many more years like that. So I and just to
complete that point. I think there's early on in a new venture, you definitely have to bring this a little bit of unconditional support and dedication to that endeavor. And I think it's hard to do it without that. The trick is to not overdo that and transition that dedication to something that's more scalable so that the company can live long term.
It is difficult. And while you were saying that, all I could think was Donald Trump. He's like a robot. He never stops. But he might be him and Richard, who is it, the Virgin guy?
Richard Branson.
Yes. They're about the only two that I think just keep on going. But I understand what you're saying. It can be very difficult. And I mean, your family can suffer. Your loved ones can feel neglected. And there does come a point where you have to really find a balance. And I'll admit it, I struggle with it. I'm a high-functioning workaholic. And I have to force myself to actually pay attention to other things that are going on in my life. I think that's fairly common. And if we're not paying attention, we can lose a lot by just simply not being aware.
Yeah, I think the other element that comes in there is that these successful entrepreneurs that you mentioned, you know, they also have a ton of people working for them. So there's also, you know, a point where, you know, being an entrepreneur also includes being a successful manager, right? Managing the resources that you have available to basically structure your life and structure the endeavor that you're engaged in. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's maybe the other piece there, that if you learn the management skills to delegate and then certainly continue to thrive your endeavors, but probably at a very different level from what you did a decade ago. So if I were to found another company, I think it would do it differently in terms of how I work with others and how I engage others to help me than I did when we founded ThinkMagic. And part of it is that, my life is very different today, right, with family and things I'm interested in. So I would have to certainly contribute, but contribute where it's essential, not necessarily contribute where others couldn't do the job.
I like that you said that. I mean, you know, sometimes it's hard for a lot of entrepreneurs to give up anything, I find. You know, we want to do it ourselves. We're so good at what we do. And I like that you just said that, you know, you should let other people kind of help you out. I love that. Okay, I'm going to try your name one more time. Is that Barn? Tell me
Bound.
One more time. Bound. I like that. Well, Bound, thank you so much for being with me here today. The book is fascinating. And you gave our audience a glimpse into your life and your systems and startup technology. And I know that the audience appreciates it as much as I do. Where can people find you on the web, and where can they purchase your book?
So, the book is definitely on Amazon and certainly other online retailers. So if you look for my name, Bernd Schoner, BERNDSCHONER, you find it on Amazon. You can type in the title, The Tech Entrepreneur's Survival Guide. That gets you there. And then I also, my website, one way of getting at it is bernd.us, BERND.US. So on there you can also find links for to purchase the book.
Well, thank you. And thank you for sending me the book. I really, really appreciate it. Well, listen, everybody, the show will be available for download in about an hour, and you can also find us in iTunes, and I will see you next week. Bound, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.